Welcome. This is Allison Bailey, and I'll be your host today on this special edition of Practice Made Perfect. As the COVID-19 pandemic continues worldwide, we've decided to add additional podcast content focused on this emergency and what's important for our cardiovascular team to know now. I'm very excited to host representatives from the geriatric cardiology section today, as we know that geriatric cardiology has come to the forefront during this time of COVID-19 because of the adverse outcomes associated with both advancing age and pre-existing cardiovascular disease in our patients. The geriatric cardiology section serves as the professional home for ACC members who focus on the care of older adults with cardiovascular disease and will discuss topics of particular interest to our older population in the time of COVID. I'm happy to welcome Dr. James Kirkpatrick, who's the director of the Echocardiography Lab at the University of Washington Medical Center, as well as one of the few ethics-trained cardiologists in the United States. He lectures and performs research in the areas of ethics and cardiac devices and palliative cardiology and serves as the chair of the Geriatric Cardiology Council. Welcome, Jim.
I'm very glad to be here, Allison. Thanks for the invitation.
You're very welcome. Next up, we have Dr. Nicole Orr. Dr. Orr is an assistant professor in the Division of Cardiology at Tufts University School of Medicine and the founder and president of Post-Acute Cardiology Care. She serves both as a staff cardiologist and consultant to skilled nursing facilities in the Northeast region and provides weekly bedside rounds for high-risk residents with cardiovascular disease. Welcome to the show, Nicole.
Hi, Allison. Thanks so much for having me.
And last, but certainly not least, is Dr. Matt Maurer. Dr. Maurer is the Arnold and Arlene Professor of Cardiology and Professor of Medicine at Columbia University Irving Medical Center. He directs the Clinical Cardiovascular Research Laboratory for the Elderly at New York Presbyterian Hospital, Columbia University Medical Center. He is a general internist and geriatric cardiologist with advanced training in heart failure. His research focuses on cardiovascular changes in older patients. Welcome, Matt.
Great to be here and pleasure to be with you and Nicole and Jim.
So it really is great to have you all join us today. Let me start out with a very basic question. Is there an age when a person transitions into geriatric cardiology, or is it really more than a number? Jim, maybe you could answer that for us.
I'll give it a try, but you know, it ends up being a complex answer because on the one hand, there are certain things that come with aging and something we call multimorbidity, a lot of conditions that pile up as we all grow older. But on the other hand, it's actually vitally important that we consider the physiologic age of the patient rather than just the chronologic age. I think most of our listeners have seen people that are well into their 80s and sometimes 90s who are incredibly robust, and other people in their 50s and even sometimes in the 40s who have multiple chronic conditions and could end up being really quite frail. So I think it's important to think about this in a very broad context and consider not just the age, but also the ramifications of the disease processes that many of our patients have.
I think that's great advice, and I tend to think of it that way, and I know most of our listeners probably do as well. Glad to know an expert does in the same way. Nicole, why is it important to discuss our geriatric population with cardiovascular disease in the setting of COVID?
So a big focus of the data collection during the pandemic from all the countries mostly affected, China, Italy, the United States, have looked at who gets the disease, and of those people who are affected, what are the risk factors that portend more disease severity and increase mortality. And they all, with some variation, tell the same story, that risk factors of hypertension, chronic cardiovascular disease, and diabetes in that order are risk factors and markers for more severe manifestations of COVID-19. And when we look at the prognosis from age, we've seen that while it's more prevalent in younger patients, and one of the largest cohorts published in March from the Chinese Centers for Disease Control and Prevention showed that the vast majority of patients were age 30 to 79, but they tended to have more mild disease, and that's where 87% of the disease was found in that age range. But while only 3% of cases were in patients over 80, the case fatality rate for patients who were older in this study was much higher, so 14.8%. So patients who are older and patients with underlying chronic conditions fare much worse, and that data has been extrapolated in various cohorts in Seattle and other countries. And interestingly, in Italy, where patients did worse and had a worse case fatality rate, it's interesting to see that it correlated with a larger aging population in Italy.
Nicole, that's great information and really important in the United States because such a significant number of individuals are living with cardiovascular disease. And as those of us in cardiology and part of the cardiac care team know, our patients tend to be older and have multiple comorbidities, including hypertension, diabetes, and pre-existing heart disease. Jim, what are some of the challenges of older adults related to COVID-19?
Well, I can actually speak from some personal experience because I had an older relative who contracted the disease, was in the hospital for 12 days, and it was very difficult. Some of the particular challenges, this person has a number of chronic comorbidities and actually ended up with some degree of mental status changes. Now, as everybody knows, patients who are currently in the hospital are isolated, especially if they have tested positive for the SARS-CoV-2 virus. They're going to not get the attention that they normally would from nursing staff, and they are also not allowed to see the loved ones that normally can sustain them through a difficult hospitalization. This certainly happened to my family member. It was very, very stressful for all of us to not know what was going on all the time, to not be able to talk with this person because they weren't able to work their cell phone due to the mental status changes. So thank God that things worked out well and this person is home and doing extremely well. But it is really challenging. We tend to forget, I think, those of us that don't have these problems, that people with chronic conditions, and especially the elderly with chronic conditions, are very reliant on caregivers. And essentially, this pandemic has taken that away from many of them, certainly when they go in the hospital, but also the isolation that's imposed on many adults, older adults who are now in nursing homes or retirement facilities and are unable to interact with other people, and they can't be visited by their family members and caregivers. And while they're not in imminent risk of dying or having some terrible comorbidity, and it is probably safer for them, there are a lot of challenges. And I think we need to, as cardiologists and cardiovascular practitioners, keep that in mind to do what we can, even besides prescribing medicines, doing procedures and everything else, that we can play a role in the larger caregiving health of our patients in this difficult time.
That's really great advice and something I've also personally witnessed, you know, being in the hospital at this sort of unorthodox time and really, you know, how the patients really long for conversation or any sort of human touch.
Absolutely.
So obviously this pandemic's affected really everything about how we deliver medicine in the United States. What do you think's been the most affected about routine testing and cardiovascular care, especially as it relates to our older patients?
Well, that is a great question. I think most of our listeners are very aware of the fact that diagnostic testing has really fallen off here intentionally. We are practicing social distancing by not doing a lot of the routine tests that we normally engage in, and that is entirely appropriate. And obviously, that's going to have a lot of ramifications when things open up again. I think we're going to be busier than ever. But at the same time, it really creates some big questions. You know, there's two ways to look at this, really, and I can speak particularly from ECHO. You can either look at saying we're going to only do those tests which we think are absolutely necessary. We're going to basically postpone everything that's quote-unquote elective, and we're really not going to do tests. We're going to try not to do tests. On the other side, you could look at it, and this is the way that we've looked at it, and said, well, if we don't do this test, what's going to happen? Rather than sort of canceling everything and then just finding the ones that we're going to do, we actually are saying, okay, well, let's look and find out the ones that we absolutely don't have to do, and we'll postpone those. There's really two different ways of looking at it, but I would argue for the latter because essentially, you know, we could say this is elective, but if this patient doesn't have a test, are they going to end up in the hospital? Are they going to use medical resources and personal protective equipment? Is this something that we could potentially avert by finding out what's going on? And I think that may also be an appropriate way to think about some of our procedures now that especially that things are loosening up a bit. How can we take the long view on all of this? And I'm hoping that as we continue to work through this, we'll hopefully be better prepared for the next time this comes around.
Yeah, I think that's something everyone's struggling with right now. So I like the approach that you're taking at your facility. How about routine follow-up visits for cardiovascular care? You know, a lot of our patients come in and see us annually or, you know, for something like heart failure, maybe more often, that aren't necessarily decompensated, but we think that keeps them out of the hospital and keeps them on track. How are those being addressed within these populations now?
We have been thinking a lot about this, and you're absolutely right to say that we need to think carefully. Basically, there are people who most of their care can probably be handled via a telemedicine visit. I will admit that we're very young in telemedicine, and we have a lot to learn about how to use it optimally. But just as I've been working with this the past few weeks, it works quite well. There are some things that you can do over the phone that don't actually need an in-person visit, especially when there's the chance an in-person visit could be dangerous to the patient. On the other hand, there are absolutely times when it's absolutely crucial that we have that in-person visit. And I think a lot of us rely very heavily on testing, and we forget about the importance of the physical exam, and for that matter, the importance of the physical touch, of the connection that there's there with the patient. As good as you are with your phone voice, you're never going to be as good as you are in patient interactions, one-on-one or one on the patient and the family member, to really create that connection and that trust. So I guess I would say I think this is going to change dramatically in the future. I think telemedicine is here to stay, and a lot more is going to be done, and it's going to be a good thing. But at the same time, we have to be creative in how we continue to make those connections with our patient and make sure that we are seeing the ones that need to be seen.
I agree. And, you know, as I listen to friends across the country doing this, I think we're all struggling with exactly who are those people. And you're right, telemedicine's received a lot of publicity during this COVID pandemic and has really helped us keep our patients out of high-risk environments. Matt, I know you have some expertise in this area. Do you have any special tips for making a successful telemedicine visit, specifically as it relates to our geriatric population?
Yeah, well, I think my expertise is rapidly growing. I would say that, you know, my initial impressions were that a lot of older adults were going to have a lot of difficulty with telemedicine, given their lack of familiarity with computers, potentially sensory and concomitant cognitive difficulties. But I've been unbelievably surprised about their ability to adapt and engage. I think it's very important for we as providers to be very flexible. While the platforms that we like to utilize are quote unquote HIPAA compliant and require secure portals, I think, you know, what we've learned is a law of thirds, that about a third of patients can engage who are older adults in those kind of platforms pretty easily, even on their first encounter. And when that's not feasible, we tend to then revert to platforms that rely on less sophisticated technology. So literally we'll switch off the platform and call the patient if they have a suitable device like FaceTime with them, and still have that telehealth and video connection so they can see our faces and interact with them. And then for the latter third who really can't communicate in either way, we tend to rely even on phone visits. And I think providers should be flexible in their approaches. We've also tried to leverage a lot of our allied health professionals and other staff who've been furloughed, if you will. So we have our nurse practitioners contacting patients, preparing them for the visits, our medical assistants doing that as well. We rely on medical assistants to do medication reconciliation, which can take a long time on the telephone, and try to reserve a lot of the rest of the visit for when the provider gets engaged for the more clinical interactions. So we encourage patients to kind of get their vital signs, their weights, especially in the world of heart failure, accrued and ready so that we can better serve their needs. You know, it's also helpful for patients when they have these premonitory visits with a nurse practitioner to brainstorm some of the questions and issues that they're facing. But I've been pleasantly surprised about how much actual medicine you can accomplish, how much you can assess patient symptoms, how they're doing, you know, even adjust medicines accordingly to try to address their healthcare needs and keep them out of the hospital. And I can't underemphasize, I think, just communicating with patients in this time is incredibly important for reducing their social isolation.
Yeah, I agree. I've had the same experience, and, you know, I found that the patients are just so profoundly grateful that they don't have to come in when they're, you know, when they're concerned about catching this virus. I'm sure you've been dealing with surges in telemedicine like everyone else is. Do you have any advice for dealing with that? You go from a practice that's really doing very little to a practice that's mostly telemedicine?
We've had that practical experience. You know, for full disclosure, Columbia Presbyterian went live with Epic on February 1st of this year. And so not only are we in a surge in telehealth, but we had to leverage a whole new electronic health record. I think it's, like I said, it's all hands on deck. Think about all the providers in your practice and how they can be leveraged to help out. Some of them require additional and new training. So, for example, this week, our medical assistants, who we leveraged to, as I mentioned, do medication reconciliation, were a little uncomfortable. They didn't understand a lot of the nuances of heart failure medicines and management. So we actually engaged the pharmacists. We did a quick Zoom video, and we taught them and continue to teach them about medications that are used in heart failure. And when the professionals' comfort level rises, they obviously tend to do a much better job. We've also broken down barriers in between providers. And so we're a large heart failure transplant and VAD program with 2,500 heart failure patients, 170 VAD patients, and almost 800 active transplant patients. And so every provider is just basically, I've been calling other providers' patients in order to pick up the slack when someone's on service in the hospital. It's really important to be flexible. Those are some suggestions to managing the surge in various practices.
Okay, I think that's great. And those all sound like great ways to improve the whole telehealth experience using team-based care, which I know we talk a lot about it at the ACC, and using our nurse practitioners, our pharmacists, as well as, our physicians and other members of the medical team, like medical assistants. Joining us today on this special episode of Practice Made Perfect with the Geriatric Cardiology section, and our focus on COVID-19 as it specifically relates to our geriatric cardiology population. We hope you'll be able to join us for part two, where we'll discuss the implications of COVID-19 on post-acute care for our patients and the specific concerns that are raised. Until then, stay safe, and we'll be listening with you soon.